at the Century Plaza Hotel, 1015 Burrard, this Friday and Saturday evening. Tickets are $25. For more information or reservations, call 604-696-9857, 696-YUCKS, or go online at yuckyucks.com. Dustin Diamond is perhaps one of the most recognizable faces in show business today. When he was in the fifth grade, he beat out 5,000 hopefuls for the role of Samuel Screech Powers on the popular television series Saved by the Bell, which was originally called Good Morning, Miss Bliss. He has appeared in other television series and movies and is also an accomplished musician and songwriter, playing bass for the band Salty the Pocket Knife. Please welcome to the commentary.ca Dustin Diamond. Good morning, Mr. Diamond.
How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Pretty good.
Saved by the Bell, we must talk about that. You'll live to be 80 years old and they'll still introduce you as Screech Powers. Are you sick of people asking you about the show?
Well, let's put it this way. You know, a lot of these child actors, they run and they hide from what made them household names. And, you know, I can understand both sides of the coin, having made myself a cultural icon of the 90s. You know, the problem is that these other guys don't know how to change their image. They don't know how they stress and strain and worry, and a lot of them get involved with drugs and everything else. Well, I've never had a drug problem. I've never robbed a bank or knocked over a liquor store. I've never been arrested. I mean, I'm young. Give me time. But you know, these guys don't know how to do anything else other than be stars, and that's hard when you're in the child star market. So I don't mind the Screech stuff at all. In fact, I talk about it in my comedy act. The thing is that, you know, if I wanted to do acting, well, Gilligan, everyone knows Bob Denver as Gilligan. Well, yeah, but he was bigger as Maynard G. Krebs before that. It just depends on what generation grew up watching him. But the thing is that I went into stand-up. I'm a comedy lover through and through, and stand-up is really the most raw form of entertainment. You know, you've got an audience, you've got a microphone, and that's it. It's just you in the spotlight and the crowd. There's no backup singers, no pyrotechnics, nothing. And you live and die by your jokes. I really enjoy it.
Now, you talked about being pigeonholed as Screech Powers. Has that prevented you, you think, from getting other roles?
No, I think the problem is, like I said, you know, it's all about reinventing yourself. And you can't come off a successful 10-year series run. I don't care how good of an actor you are or how lucky you get, you know, to get breaks. People are, you know, we are a pattern recognition-based species. And so coming off of that, you know, you basically have a situation where I could go out there and try and, you know, get different roles and say, you know, please don't see me as this character. And they're going to say, see you as what? Screech? And you know, and it's kind of like a double-edged sword. And, but it's the same with anything, you know, I mean, like I said, pattern recognition. So when I go into stand-up, when I do my stand-up, you know, when I first started out especially, you had to mention Screech was doing stand-up to get people into the seats, because no one knew my real name. So, you know, to come out there, but then that's where I win them over, see, is that in my comedy act, I'm the one writing it, not, you know, a team of writers on, you know, on Saturday morning. So I'm really speaking my own lines and talking about material that I want to talk about from the heart. And once people leave my show, they really have, I get a lot of great feedback. I've been compared to Carlin a number of times by people. I think 17 is my count so far. You got to count that. Carlin's a hero, you know.
Wow. Was it easier for you to go into stand-up because you came from a sitcom?
It was easy to go into stand-up because I'm a natural performer. I mean, I'm 28, and I've been performing for 20 years. And so, really, you know, I mean, in stand-up, I've only got, you know, roughly 5 years under my belt. But the thing is that unlike, you know, other guys where they're doing five years, they're not very good, they're having to learn things that some people can't be taught, and some people don't gain until they've been in the business a certain period of time. And that's delivery, timing, and stage presence. And I really think that those three are the magic, whole of the pie. Or in other words, like, I think that's really 80 to 85% of a stand-up act. I think the other, you know, 15, 20%, or maybe even 10% is your actual material.
George Burns said that dying was easy and comedy was hard. You say you're a natural performer since you were 8 years old. Is comedy as hard as it seems to make people laugh?
Well, half the world laughs at the other half, and I really think that, you know, especially since I do Canada as well as the States, you know, in Canada, you've got, you know, areas are different, but, you know, the whole of Canada is, you pretty much have, you know, it's a good country. It's, you know, everyone's pretty much unified and together, whereas in the States, I'm sure you hear all about it, you know, you got the presidents always come in and do weird, crazy stuff. You got every, you know, state has its own accent, its own, you know, attitude, from L.A. to Florida to New York to Idaho, I mean, to Texas, and everybody wants so bad to be their own thing. Well, in that wanting to separate and differentiate so much, they're, you know, you're basically, that affects people's moods and what they think is funny and their perception, and here I'm getting on stage with a room of people that may have come from totally different areas, and I've got to try and find a way to make them all laugh uniformly. And I get it done. I get the job done. And it's really, I think, touching on... I think the crux of my act is really about relationships. I really dig down into relationships, and I think everybody can relate to relationships. Now, I don't mean just relationships with a husband or a wife or boyfriend, girlfriend. I mean relationships with, you know, your brother, your... you know, your government or your authority figures, you know, bosses, co-workers, pets, everything. So any kind of relationship and interactivity between humans and animals and everything else, that's really where I like to break the species down, because that's going back to our primal instincts. You can't separate. It doesn't matter where you're from or what genes you have in you. I mean, you know, primal instincts and primal urges are what tie us all together as a species.
Do you get topical in your act? I mean, is that hard to do if you're going from Texas and then if you go to Boise or if you go to New York?
Well, yeah, and that's really hard, and that's why I like to avoid certain things. Like topical issues, I really, if it's something important or something I want to talk about, I'll do it. But it's, like, I don't sit there and go, I'm going to definitely not mention anything about this today. I mean, if something comes up in the news, I'm going to talk about it. But I'm not a political comedian. I leave that to guys like Lewis Black, who can really, you know, or Bill Maher, who can really get in there and, you know, and break stuff down and then do it. Myself, I'm all about having, you know, I'm not at a pep rally. You know what I mean? It's like I'm not trying to win people's votes. I just want people to go away from my show thinking, you know what, out of a stressful day, I had a crappy work week, you know what, tonight was good. I had a great evening, and that's really my goal.
How much of your act, the set that you do every night, how much of that is preset? How much is pre-written, and how much of that is engaging the audience when you're up on stage?
Well, there's a thing with comedy, okay? There are comedians who don't have much of an act, and so they go to the audience the entire time. Then there's guys who go to the audience just because, you know, they've been doing their act for a long time, and sometimes you get bored, and you get, you know, comedy is therapy, you know, I mean, it really is a soapbox from which I shout and scream and force my opinions on others, you know, and the thing is that I have a lot of material, okay, and I switch it up all the time, and, you know, there's things that just come out on the fly, without even going to the audience. There are things that just come out on the fly, and the way comedy usually works, and, you know, when it's working the way it's supposed to, is, you know, if you're, we call it riffing in the biz, you know, if you're riffing and just going off the cuff, then, you know, something comes up and the audience laughs, even you might be on stage hearing it for the first time, even though you said it, and might be going, whoa, you know, that's pretty funny,
yeah.
And, you know, I'm gonna put that in my act again, I'm gonna use that again. And so you do, and then you'll now that you're doing it again, you'll find different ways of making that funnier or work, you know, trimming the fat basically. Richard Pryor was notorious for it. He used to take, you know, 20-minute bits, but by the time you saw them and they were done and polished and all the fat was trimmed, you're down to like, you know, 3, 4, 5-minute bit tops, you know, and all the rest of that, you know, 10 to 17 to sometimes 18 minutes. We're all cut off, all the fluff, and it was sharp and tight and funny and punchy. And the thing is that comedy is work. It's not easy. We make it look easy up there, but, you know, it really is. I mean, think about it. Most people in my line of work start out in stand-up comedy, hope to get a TV show. I'm doing it backwards. I had a TV show, now I'm doing stand-up. Next year I'll be doing security work with Gary Coleman. If I keep this up, I got to watch it.
I ought to ask because people will I'll get emails if I don't ask you about Saved by the Bell. So indulge me for a second. A couple of questions about the show. The chemistry, you obviously had some great chemistry with the other cast members. On screen, what was it like off screen?
Well, the thing is that I was 11 when we started, okay, and they were, you know, like 14, 15 years old. So the thing is that I was kind of like the tag-along brother. When they were getting, you know, going into college, I was just going into high school. And at that age, that's a huge difference, you know. And I was wacky, and I was wild, and I was real hyper, you know. And so, you know, here I am, 11 years old, being forced to, you know, to stand. Well, I wouldn't say forced, but you know what I mean. I'm required to be working in all day, you know, where other kids are going off to school and playing with their friends. You know, so, you know, you find ways to entertain yourself. The older kids were at that point where they were, you know, they were, they're all roughly the same age. They're all young teens with hormones going crazy, you know, hanging out. But, you know, me, I entered the fray a little earlier than everyone else. And so, or a little younger than everyone else. So, because of that, you know, the, how do I put it delicately, the romances and the things that, the mistakes that a lot of the cast members made, which made work tough, I managed to avoid. In fact, the girls that I dated during that time period were a lot of the background girls that you'll see on the show. A lot of the girls that walk by in the background that have no lines or dialogue, and, you know, they replace those girls every month, or every week, rather. So, you know, every 7 days, we had a new batch of young ladies for the D-Man to do the hunt.
Was there a lot of dating that went on amongst the cast?
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of stuff. When something was written in the script, they would kind of manifest it, you know. And the thing is that, you know, the problem that young kids don't realize, I consider myself an exception to the rule, because I was aware of this at a young age, is that, I can't say it right now because of all the rules with what you can say on bandwidth, but let's just say you don't blank where you eat, you know what I mean? You follow? So, you know, you make your bed, you got to sleep in it, you know, and so these romances turn sour, as they often do with teenagers. And now you're forced to work with that person every day.
Right.
And then on screen, you're supposed to be nice, and if you're not, you know, a world-class A-list actor, it's going to come through as bad acting or as false, you know, and you're supposed to be nice to someone or love someone that you actually hate, you know, or you know, hate someone that you actually love. It's not going to come off well. And so, you know, also you got all these guys out there saying, Kelly, Jesse, Lisa, all these girls, all these beautiful women. And yet, you know, when you're there working with them every single day and you get to see their lowest points as well as their highest points, you know, it really, people are not as beautiful, you know, on the inside sometimes when you're romantically, anyway, when you're working with them every day. It really does become like a brother-sister relationship.
The other thing that they wanted me to ask is, do you all still make money off of the show since it's seen in like 105 countries around the world?
Yeah, it's in 106 countries, 16 times a week, and at least that's the last count I had on it. And yeah, we get residual checks every time it airs, you know, but they're not huge. Like, people think, oh, you're making millions. Well, no.
It's not
you do that with how you invest your money. You know, it's you know, the how do I put it? Every time the show airs, the money gets less.
Right.
So if the show's aired once, you may get, you know, $300-$400. If it airs 100 times, you may get $3 or $4.
So it isn't Seinfeld money you're making off this thing.
Oh, no, no, no. In fact, their residuals, they still don't make that much. Residuals are all determined by the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, or AFTRA.
One last question. I'm gleaning this from the news. Were you ever a guest at the Neverland Ranch?
No. Why, did they say I was on the news?
No, I just, you know, you have to ask these questions.
Yeah, that hurts my feelings, you know. I never got invited. You know, sure, all the kids were potentially molested, but, you know, I mean, come on, you know. I was a good-looking kid, wasn't I? At least the offer should have been made. But we did have ties to Michael at one point. The guy who used to play Max on the show, Ed Alonso, who owned the Max, in the first 7 episodes, he actually was a comedy magician before the show and during and after, and he performed. Michael, I guess, loved magic, and he had Ed Alonso come to the Neverland Ranch to perform, and so it was kind of funny, like an old Saved by the Bell alumni, even from the very beginning. Got to go to the infamous Neverland Ranch, you know. He was okay, though, because he was in his 30s.
I think he would know better, that's for sure. Well, Dustin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure thing.
And break a leg on, I guess you can say that to a comedian, can you?
Well, yeah, you know what, I always, you know, as a good comic, I always have these little catchphrases and things that I come up with on the moment that I file away. And one of my famous things that I always say is, people always say good luck. And I always reply with my little retort, because I don't think luck plays a factor in honing your craft. I say, good luck. I say, no luck, all skill.
There you
all
go.
All skill. So thanks a lot, man.
There you go. Check out Dustin Diamond at Yuck Yucks at the Century Plaza on Burrard Street Friday and Saturday night. Tickets are $25 and available by calling 604-696-9857. YuckYucks.com will get you more information as well. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plunup.